Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, July 20th, 2026, and we're glad to be here with you today. My name is Magnus Teeble. Joining me in the studio is
Peter R.H.
And we got a bunch of different stuff lined up for you. We're going to start the show with an interview with UBC researcher Dr. Jonathan Evans from the Sauder School of Business. He's going to be talking, he researches sort of business culture, particularly as it relates to workplaces and making workplaces friendlier and less troubled, particularly around issues of racism, sexism, stuff like that. How can leaders build a positive culture? And so we're going to be doing, we have an interview with him because he's done, him and another colleague have done some research into how male leaders should respond in meetings, work meetings and similar, when sexist comments come up in the meeting, and it's not necessarily exactly how you think. We also have a report from Danny Nesvadarani about a new exhibition about climate science art exhibition, and an interview with Desiree Patterson of this exhibition, which is at the Reach Gallery Museum in Abbotsford. Of course, we have Gardening with Embark, talking about our midsummer tasks and dealing with maturing plants in our gardens and what to do with them. And we're going to be talking to Peter R.H. And what are you talking about today, Peter?
Well, they got that new Odyssey movie out.
Yeah.
And Democracy Now! Mentioned about that, what I think it was that it was partly filmed in Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certain human rights issues with that.
Right.
But I have other reasons why you should just avoid the movie, because the thing was that both the Ilvine Odyssey were actually, they thought that was true.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't really believe it, it's kind of like, what's the point? You know, it's sort of like, I mean, you know what I mean? It's sort of like, what would be the point of the thing? I mean, I don't know if it's that great of a story. You know, there was a remake of the movie Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Mm-hmm.
And what had and Peter O'Toole.
Refresh my memory. That's the one. Is that the one where he's a senator or something? What is that one?
No, Goodbye, Mr. Chips. He is in he is a teacher in an English boarding school.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
And the 1939 one, he's more of a softer personality. But in the late 60s one, or 1970, whatever it is, with Peter O'Toole, he's shown to be a bit of a taskmaster. And one of the things is that he's making the kids learn the Iliad and the Odyssey. And they're, of course, bored stiff at it.
Right.
And he's sort of taking the task. And then he sort of laments about half hour later in the movie whether he's really doing anything important. But that was part of the culture at the time.
Yeah.
I don't know. Hopefully it stopped. But I think I talked to somebody and said, hey, we did take it in high school, and I mean, it's sort of like a,
you know, it's part of the basic education in the sort of more elite levels. And by elite, I mean wealthier levels of, for an English educational culture, they would, you know, you would learn Greek and Latin, and then you'd be able to read all those things in the original language, which was, I guess, doesn't happen as much anymore because it's just,
I don't
probably
think
not as useful
all.
To
I
be able
imagining.
To know Greek and Latin, unless you're going to become a historian or similar.
Well, at a high school level, I don't think Latin is taught.
All right, so we're going to talk about the Odyssey, the new film, and Homer's epic.
And ancient Greek culture in general and context with it.
At Peter's segment at the end of the show.
Yeah.
But first off, we have our interview with Dr. Jonathan Evans. Dr. Jonathan Evans is an assistant professor at UBC's Sauder School of Business, and along with fellow researcher and PhD student Brad Huang, has been conducting research into how male leaders should react to sexist remarks in meetings and other situations like that. It's part of a broader scope of research looking into how to create better cultures within business workplaces. You've been researching what happens and how male leaders in particular respond to incidents of sexist remarks in work meetings and similar situations. Why did you decide to examine this issue?
Well, first of all, there's like a prevalence of this kind of behavior in the workplace that we don't like. And my co-author and I, we thought that, sure, we have some research findings about the importance of confronting the sexist remark. But what usually happens when these kinds of things occur is that leaders are kind of in a deer in the headlights kind of situation of not knowing what to do. Like, there's other people in the room. There's lots of ways that you could confront. And we wanted to provide some clarity that would allow leaders to have like a baseline understanding of how they should react in those kinds of situations.
Imagine a lot of situations because of that deer in the headlight sort of effect that often, and the awkwardness of the whole situation, that often people just sort of try and move on.
Yes, absolutely. And plenty of people that we've talked to, that was kind of a response we've heard. And probably a little bit of that combined with the leadership aphorism that leaders should praise in public and criticize in private. Right. We think that maybe those two things together is why most male leaders, when we ask them how would they respond, they indicated that any kind of confrontation that they would do, confronting the person who made the remark, that they're more likely to do that in private. And so we wanted to look at, well, is that the preference of the person who's been harmed by the remark?
Yeah. And what did you find?
Yeah, so we ran an experiment that allowed our female participants to react to hearing a sexist remark in a team meeting and then react to different ways that a leader might respond to that. Right. And what we found is that when the leader responded by confronting the person in public, female employees or female participants in our study, they indicated that was the best way to shape social norms going forward. And confronting in public helped them feel more belonging and more willingness to contribute in the next meeting because they felt that belonging.
So with this, it's an awkward situation. So how should male leaders be responding?
Mm. In terms of the public confrontation, mm-hmm. what we found was that if you express some kind of displeasure of the comment, I didn't like that comment, that's demeaning to women. So some kind of explanation of the harm that the comment makes. Yeah. But probably most importantly, some kind of comment indicating that it has no place in the culture you're trying to create. Like, that kind of comment has no place in our culture. That's not appropriate for our workplace environment. You know, kind of indicating that it doesn't belong in the mm-hmm. place that it was expressed. Yeah,
I imagine part of the, as a leader, you'd be looking for in terms of your reaction is not just to deal with the incident in the moment and that, but as you say, address the larger cultural issue of your organization and doing so more publicly or at least involving the group would seem to support that as more than dealing with it privately.
Mm-hmm. Completely agree. And one of the things that we looked at as well was, like, we prioritized what are the preferences of the person harmed by the comment.
Right.
But we also recognize that it is an important objective to reduce the likelihood that that person is going to make a similar comment. So we also examined, okay, how does that offender respond if you confront him in public versus in private. And unsurprisingly, we found that they felt like their dignity wasn't protected and they felt a little less belonging in the group, which are probably costs that you're willing to pay in order to get the benefit of establishing social norms. But it's useful to know that because it's probably useful to have, in addition to that public confrontation, some kind of follow-up conversation with that individual privately to help assuage some of those hurt feelings so that you can encourage that person to change behavior and not sort of like engage in backlash or double down on the bad behavior because of how they felt defensive about it.
So is there ways, you know, in the moment, in the meeting, is there better ways than others of trying to, you mentioned a couple ideas, but that a leader can respond. And what are ways that might not be helpful?
So one of the things we found that is not helpful is, because we also looked at behaviors beyond just confronting. We also looked at doing something to offer validation or support for the person who was harmed by the remark. And we similarly asked the question, okay, should that be done in public or private? And we found that women, the participants in our studies that that experienced different forms of validation, they overwhelmingly preferred that that kind of validation be done in private. And some of the ways that you could offer validation would be expressing your displeasure of the remark, and then offering her options of how she might want to either express her feelings about it or not, or, you know, take a break and kind of separate from work a little bit, whatever, kind of give some options of what she might want to do to deal with how she may or may not have felt about it.
One thing you mentioned as not being a good idea is having leaders apologize on behalf of the offender, though, taking that role. How does that play into it? And why does that end being, why does that come across as a problem?
Yeah, that was an interesting thing that we discovered.
I would think that maybe, you know, for a lot of people, it might seem you're stepping up to do that.
Yeah, I could see how that would be a natural desire of a leader to express. We discovered that as we were kind of pilot testing different ways of offering validation. And as we were pilot testing it with different groups of female participants, what we found was that they would pretty consistently comment when we attempted to provide any kind of apology language. That's not appropriate to apologize for that person. The other feedback we would got on different types of validation efforts was don't presume that you know what her experience was. You know, don't say like, oh, that must have been harmful for you, or you must not have been, you know, you must have really not liked that. That kind of language presumes that you understand how she felt about it. And so as opposed to that kind of language, kind of open-ended questions that allow her to express what her experience was, that's more validating than presuming that you actually understand it.
So in following up afterwards, particularly with the people who might have been harmed by the incident, what are your recommendations around that? And would you do it? You know, there might be several women in this meeting who are offended. Do you talk to them as a group or do you address it individually?
That's a good question. So in our study, we examined group dynamics where there was one female in a group of male coworkers. So my data can't speak to recommendations regarding several women in the group. Based upon our findings, I would suggest individual follow-up would be better to again allow there to be that autonomy of each person can express how they individually felt about it. And the language that we found, expressing your displeasure of the remark, offering options of how she might want to respond, sharing feelings, taking a break, those were the validation responses that received the highest levels of preference from those who are harmed by such a remark.
So for male leaders to, you know, to avoid that deer in the headlight sort of response to something like this, what should they be thinking about ahead of time? I mean, I don't mean specific meetings, but I mean, you never know when this might happen. And and a lot of, as with many situations, like if you've sort of thought about it ahead of time, you're better prepared to react in the moment.
Yeah. And there's another component of this, having thought about it ahead of time, before I'll get to my, like, what I think is the key, like, thing to remember, is that if you've thought about it ahead of time and you've got a baseline script in your head or baseline understanding how to respond, that just allows you to calmly think about the particulars of any individual circumstance and make adjustments. Because one of the key ideas of our findings is that you should think about what a person's preferences are that might not be what you think they are. And ultimately, I think the key thing to remember, confront him in public, validate her in private. And then, like I said, if you have that as a baseline understanding that that's the general preference, then you're able to then adjust to the individual circumstances of the event. And because you have a baseline understanding, then you feel a little more calm about making those adjustments.
So I'm curious sort of about how you conducted this research, because it's a touchy subject, and you know, in thinking about it quickly, obviously you're going much deeper into it. I'm wondering how you conduct a research like this without replicating the harm that you're researching, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. And naturally, all of our research studies are reviewed by an ethics board to confirm that the things that we do are not harmful to the people that participate. And what we wanted to be able to do is compare specific responses from a leader. So what we needed to do was set up these experiments where the only thing that changed was the leader's response. Like the language was the same, but just like private or public context. And so we recruited participants into an online study. They engaged in a group task where they were coming up with ideas for creating a new app. And then in the group conversation, we scripted it such that the same set of three typical sexist remarks were, one of the three were expressed in the meeting. And then we had the leader either, you know, confront or not. If they confronted, and they would do it in private or public, and the language was the same. That way we could narrow in on exactly what was making the difference in terms of how did our female participants respond to the experience.
Do you find, you know, I'm guessing this is sort of part of a larger set of research related around these topics, is it?
It is. We were contributing mostly to the research on confronting sexist remarks. Yeah. We kind of added to that in a couple of ways.
Do these things still happen a lot in professional environments?
Yeah, that's when we framed our paper at the very beginning, we kind of brought up the fact that despite the fact that we've had, you know, many years of research indicating ways to reduce it, it still happens. It still exists. Right. And I would venture to guess that you know, as society continues to make adjustments and changes regarding its you know, preference regarding these things, it's going to ebb and flow the amount of prevalent these comments occurring in the workplace.
So to finish up here, what would be your sort of quick advice to male leaders to get themselves ready to handle these situations in the best way?
Yeah, aside from the sort of like phrase, confront him, validate her, the other key principle I hope that male leaders sort of like fully digest and incorporate into their thinking is take a moment and consider what her preferences might be. And recognize that, don't make assumptions about it, and you probably don't know, so ask some questions and put some effort into understanding what her preferences are. And if you do that, even in a sort of clumsy, fumbling way, the fact that you are sort of like other focused is going to be, I think, ultimately helpful.
Well, excellent. Thanks so much for looking into this and talking to us about it today. I think it's really good advice for, well, for male leaders in particular, but really anyone in that situation of leading meetings. You know, odd things can happen in meetings in a lot of different ways, and it's not always easy to know what to do in the moment of the situation.
Absolutely.
Thanks for talking
to me.
Thanks
for having me. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to talk with you. Thank you.
Great. Dr. Jonathan Evans is an assistant professor at the UBC Sauder School of Business and researching, I guess, workplace culture. What's your broader area of research that
you... So my broader area is the signals that leader behavior sends to groups. And so I look at lots of different ways that leaders might act and how that signals the way others should act and think.
Well, that sounds both very interesting, but also quite a complex topic.
It is. What makes it fun.
Excellent. Well, thanks for speaking to me today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that was Dr. Jonathan Evans, assistant professor in UBC Sauder School of Business and researcher on workplace cultures. Thanks for that. Hope you found some valuable takeaways from that interview that you can apply in your workplace if you're a leader, but really anywhere in life and thinking how to deal with these situations. Let's take a quick look at the weather for this week. It's going to be a pretty nice day or a pretty nice week, really, with weather very much like the weekend, with mainly sunny, with a bit of cloud coming and going. Highs up to 24 and 25 today, getting up to... Well, that's about as hot as it gets this week. It's going to cool off a little bit, but towards the end of the week, down with highs up to 22, which is pretty manageable, but overall mainly sunny. So a really nice mid-July week here for us all week here in Vancouver.
This is Bird Note. I'm J. Drew Lanham, an ornithologist, naturalist, and writer. I'm often asked, what's your favorite bird? My standard response is, the one with feathers. Birds deserve more than the disappearing by billions and reducing them to just names on a list. But here's the recent taxonomy of my obsessions, selected birds of the moment, annotated by Y. White-crowned sparrow. Envying the brown ignored thing, all sparrows and BIPOC are top of the list. Loggerhead shrike, stuck on a raptorial passerine. This bad boy is a songbird that hunts. Bobolink, a.k.a. rice bird. Blackbirds are my birds. History lesson. Rice bird ancestors shared the terror and toil in low country rice fields with enslaved black people. They were persecuted for eating the rice that made the planter class filthy rich so they could enslave even more black people and grow more rice. See the cycle? There you have it. Three fave birds and why. This list is subject to change and write soon. Stay tuned. I'm J. Drew Lanham.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
From Abbotsford, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Interglacial, a warmer period of time defined by the end of one ice age and the start of another. Yet, with our current era being defined by ever-increasing climate change, that cycle becomes more and more precarious. Interglacial. Desiree Patterson's new exhibition at the Reach Gallery Museum, which is focused on that precarity and the climate crisis we find ourselves in. The product of her work as the 2025 Artist in Residence for the United Nations Year for Glaciers Preservation, Interglacial consists of five new installations, each inspired by the environmental climate scientists she partnered with during her residency. Through these partnerships, Patterson utilized the scientific data collected, shaping it into lens-based and non-lens-based artwork and imagery. There are images that highlight 100 years of glacial degradation, suspended smoky pieces of wood that evoke British Columbia's now yearly wildfire seasons, and a massive structure of cyanotype textiles connected and hung to form the shape of a glacier. The exhibit is a grand immersive experience. However, at the heart of any creative work is the reason behind it. And when we got the chance to speak with Patterson during Interglacial's opening tour, she made that reason immediately clear.
This exhibition is primarily, even on the introduction didactic, this is dedicated to my daughter. I have a 6-year-old daughter, her name is Meadow, and it is really my concern for her future and future generations after, what they're inheriting. And I think one of the most beautiful aspects of this past year and of my experience is approaching all of this wanting to bring forth information and empower and engage and rally. I'm also absolutely bursting with hope in this moment. And it's because I've just spent a year working alongside and personally, you know, being able to engage with these researchers that are essentially providing the blueprints and, you know, the policy and all the information required to have a more hopeful future. I just got to hang out with them for a year and see the kind of people doing this work. So another key component of this communication is also to help restore the faith in science. And I think by trying to humanize that and share this research in a different way, but also through the video didactics and the interviews that we have accompanying every single section that really do highlight these researchers and these scientists and their life's dedication work, I really hope that that is also communicated through this exhibition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was gonna ask you about the hope aspect specifically, because, you know, there are parts of this exhibition that do provide like this outlook of hope regarding our current climate, but at the same time, you also see photos and images of wildfires and 100 years of difference between glacial landscapes. It wouldn't surprise me if someone saw that and immediately their hope is kind of like gone, just from looking at that alone. So where do you suggest, or where do you find hope in the work that you do that looks so closely at climate change and how things have unfortunately progressed in the past century?
I find hope in people. I find hope in humans. And it's really beautiful to say that, because I often hear people say, oh, look at what humans have done to this planet. We don't deserve this world. And notions like that. But I don't buy that at all. I see people doing selfless work. I see scientists, you know, taking time away from their families to do extensive field work across summers, and these inherently creative people and curious people devoting their life to understanding one little part of an ecosystem. That gives me hope, to see people that filled with love and that filled with passion. It gives me hope to have conversations with other like-minded Canadians and understand that they carry the same kind of concerns that I do. Having a 6-year-old daughter is, I think, hope. You know, the youth of this generation are weighted with, I think, a lot of complicated situations that they've inherited. But I think they're rallying, and what I see, like the Greta Thunbergs of the world, that gives me hope. And I think also just like knowing from a lot of the different high-level researchers that I have had the privilege to speak with, there are fundamental feedback systems in nature that allow this planet to be so regenerative. And we haven't breached that yet. So in this moment, I have hope, because we can change the trajectory that we're on. That's a fact. That isn't an opinion or an optimistic view. It is a cold, hard fact. What we need is that political will, and what we need is that we need that conviction for everybody to stand up and demand it right here, right now. And I think it's coming, and I think it's going to happen. And as an individual, this show is just my way of helping, trying to foster that.
Mm-hmm. Another question I had was, you know, that when we went through each section of this exhibition, you kind of named every single section as having its own muse. And, you know, working with scientific researchers, I'd imagine as much as you initially weren't as familiar with, like, their scientific process, they probably also weren't familiar at all with how exhibitions or art galleries work. How did they feel about being, like, direct inspirations for how this exhibition was put together?
That is such a great question. They're all such modest people, so they've all been kind of, I think, really curious to see this portrayal. But like you said, we come from different worlds, and, you know, an analytical brain is often firing different thoughts and different ways of seeing than a creative brain. So to me, and to many of them, it's a really beautiful partnership. It really kind of enhances the ability to tell a story and to communicate, I think, in a fuller, richer way. But I think I haven't had the opportunity for them to actually see their work yet. And I'm really looking forward to that moment, to actually just looking into their eyes and just seeing how they receive what my contemporary translation of them as a researcher is. And I think just from the conversations that I've had, even just from doing the field work, they're really excited about it. You know, most of scientific findings is communicated through papers circulated amongst academic institutions and in those communities. And it almost, you know, compared to, like, the public audiences, it's almost like an esoteric language. And so I think they're really excited to see how art can kind of bridge that, and how engagement can be fostered through different means than intellect, I guess.
In saying that, the last question I had, it might be a bit of a loaded one, but for those who do attend this exhibition, is there a central takeaway that you hope audiences have when looking at this as a whole?
Yeah. Well, there's a few. I hope people take the time to just experience the work for themselves. I hope that people have the opportunity to watch some of the interviews and have the opportunity to form a sense of trust with the people who are sharing this really important information of this moment with us, the experts that know these ecosystems, that know these dynamics, these feedbacks, these models, these forecasts, and have that time and space to discern for themselves, you know, what they resonate with and what they feel educated by. And then I hope that what this shows as an exhibition as a whole is an act of advocacy. So as an individual, I started getting involved in environmentalism before it ever permeated into my practice. And I realized early on, you know, I'm marching in climate rallies, I've, you know, became a vegetarian, I've lowered my carbon footprint, all these kinds of things. And I know that the notion is like, oh, well, that's so much, but really, does it have an impact? And you know what? It does have an impact on your health, for sure. It's a positive, because anything I've ever done environmentally focused has actually benefited my health. But does it affect, you know, greenhouse gas emissions by large? Probably not. But it has affected my mental health. It has affected me feeling positive and feeling accountable to the future. But I realized that the loudest voice that I would have as an individual is through my creative practice. So what this show is an individual citizen who is just trying to use the unique skills that they have to communicate something really important to their heart. We all have the capacity to do this. We all have unique skill sets. We all have passion that we carry in our heart, and we have a voice that we need to use for those who don't have one. That's what I hope the takeaway is. Whatever it is, whatever calls you to your heart and soul, and whatever you have as your unique talents, your gifts, your place in this world, we need everybody in this moment to stand up, and we need everybody to voice, and we need everybody to advocate for the future that we want.
Once again, that was our conversation with Desiree Patterson, the exhibiting artist for Interglacial at the Reach Gallery Museum in Abbotsford. The opening of the exhibition was on July 11th, but this exhibition will be on until March 20th, 2027 at the Reach Gallery Museum. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Did you know the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPERG, has been leading social and environmental activism on campus for 40 years? SFPERG is student activism, by students, for students. Do you have a vision for a brighter future? Are you passionate about changing the world? Visit us at www.sfperg.ca. That's www.sfperg.ca to learn more about getting involved today.
If you want to respond to anything you hear on Speak Up, or anywhere else you hear it on CJSF Radio, you're welcome to give us a call here in the studio or send us a text message with your comments. You can do that at 778-782-2573. That's 778-782-2573, CJSF. We'd love to get your comments. We love to hear from our audiences and what you're thinking about the stories we're doing. So please give us a shout. In about 10 minutes, we're going to be back to talk about the Odyssey. But first, we have Gardening with Embark. All right, it's time now for Gardening with Embark. And joining me in the studio here, as he does every week, is Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability and our gardens expert. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here. Good morning, everyone.
So we're into week 29.
Correct, week 29 is passing very fast. week 26, elementary, secondary schools went into summer break.
Yeah.
And we are in week 29, so going very fast. At this time of the year, we gardeners consider this as a midsummer.
Mm-hmm.
The midsummer, because it's 21, June the 21st was the solstice, so
yeah.
We are already almost a month away from that.
Yeah.
So yeah, we are midsummer. At this time, we gardeners, in particular in our garden, we see plants that are getting old.
Yeah.
And therefore being a nice environment for aphids. Yeah.
So they've sort of grown what they're going to grow and matured as much as they're going to usefully.
Yeah. Usefully, yes. So they have matured and then, yeah. So we have some plants that went into flower like the su choy, pak choy, spinach. And the other ones, the kale, that is a biennial plant. At the moment is attacked by aphids.
Right.
So it's completely covered with aphids. So at the moment is there's nothing to do with that. It's just remove the plant completely.
Yeah.
And then we have other crops like the peas. They are nice little small pods.
Yeah.
But the leaves are starting to be covered with white powdery mildew. So again, there's nothing else.
Now, do those things happen because the plant is sort of matured? Is it something related to their life cycle?
Yeah, it's related to the life cycle. Plants are maturing, therefore they are getting weak, and so the leaves are drying up from the bottom towards the tip of the plant. And although we here water the soil, so we tend to avoid watering the leaves itself.
Yeah.
So the plant presented the diseases. So, yeah, it's time that the plant is telling us, I'm done. And since we use an intensive gardening method called square foot gardening, so once the plant, we see the plant is done, we mm-hmm. just remove it,
yeah.
add a bit of compost, mix, and yeah. a new crop comes in. Yeah.
Right. And that's important to keep those pests from spreading to your other plants.
Yes. Yeah. They come. You don't bring them. They just show up. And we want to prevent that they spread more. What we do is just trim at the bottom of the plant and carefully we move that into a designated compost for plants with infested plants and plants with diseases, plants with seeds and wheat. Everything goes in one different container. We don't add this to the compost.
Yeah.
We don't tend to add this to the compost because, the aphids, the lay eggs will be there, and our composter doesn't reach high temperatures to right. kill these little eggs of the aphids.
So they might even overwinter.
And they come back to the garden.
You add some lovely soil to your garden, and all of a sudden, boom.
Yep. Yeah. So we don't do that. So
and the seeds are an issue too, because of course, same thing. If they're there, they're gonna. You put the soil back in, and all of a sudden, you've got a whole bunch of plants you weren't planning on.
Correct. So what happened to this time was we had volunteer tomatoes.
Yeah.
So somehow some tomatoes ended up in the compost. We harvest the compost. We add to the garden bed, and there we have some volunteer tomato plants growing. Right. So our the way that we compost in here is it doesn't get too hot. So yeah. therefore, kind of the eggs of insects and diseases, and then the egg seeds or weeds and other plants, they just don't die. So yeah.
Yeah.
That's happening in our garden, so time to start being a good janitor, mm-hmm. removing, tidying up, cleaning, adding a bit more compost, and continue planting. We still have until September to right. start continue seeding, and then, once September arrives, we start in winter mode.
Right. So you're talking about adding compost. With the style of gardening you do, do you also or not use fertilizers?
Well, we don't use chemical fertilizers
yeah.
or synthetic fertilizers. We yeah. try, we use compost, and if we have some organic matter like you can buy cheap waste bagged,
yeah.
so we can buy that and add it to our garden.
Right.
But mostly we just use compost. We can go to a garden center where we have a veggie mix or a soil amender, mm-hmm. which is very well rotting manure, compost, mushroom manure, all mixed together.
Yeah.
And we can buy that and as well add it. So we don't use any synthetic fertilizer.
Right. Good. So what else is happening in the garden?
What else? Oh, the deer.
We've had a bit of a dry spell.
Yes. So if you are familiar with SFU campus here in Burnaby Mountain, you will see that all the green areas are slowly turning brown. And we have resident deer walking around.
Because we're surrounded by a nice little forest.
Forest, yes. But they find that the sweet grass from their favorite spot is gone.
Yeah.
They came to the garden and they raided it. So now today in the morning arrived and all the tomato plants, the leaves are stripped, just sticks. The same with the beans, the peas, the Swiss chard, and the beets. All leaves are gone. And like, onions, they are not interested in onions. Surprisingly, the onions are staying there, but the rest is all gone. Neither from the corn, we have corn as well. The corn is standing well, but the rest, is they decide to eat it. That's normal because around everything is dry, and we have our beautiful garden green. We water frequently, so why not?
So when that happens, do you just have to pull those plants out and put something else in, or can they recover? I guess it depends how badly they've been chopped.
At this moment, with tomato plants, is kind of done.
Yeah.
Because we are midsummer, so at the moment, starting for getting another plant will be a bit expensive if you can't find it.
Yeah.
So it kind of is done. With the beans, is the beans, we just remove the plant and we can plant a second crop of beans.
Right.
Yeah. With the peas, as I mentioned, they are already dying and being affected by white powdery mildew, so we just harvest it and we can plant something else. Yeah. And with the beets, they are all nice, ready to harvest. So it was time to harvest. So
right. So Chris, the deer, they eat off all the greenery, but you can still down and get the vegetables. So.
Yeah, the root is out for the beets. Yes, yeah. And with Swiss chard, they will mount it back, so it's no problem.
So
the most important is tomatoes. Everybody grows tomatoes over the summer because you want to have a beautiful tomato, but the deer shows up and eats all the leaves, and then you are just with a sticks. No leaves, no food for the plant, so the plant's kind of starving until some new leaves show up, and that it sets back usually at least 2 weeks back until the plant can make new leaves. So just after, what I always advise, just remove the plant and plant something else. Use the, because our space is small, so we try to optimize the space as much as we can. And this year is no tomato, so that is gardening.
Yeah. So many things to deal with, the pests, the deer, the dry spells, the rainy spells.
The raining spells, so no raining, although I have seen the forecast in the coming week is going to be kind of rainy, but... the weather is so nice. We are, again, yesterday was so hot in the afternoon. So these days have been very, very hot in the afternoon, which I'm used to be in the sun. But, yesterday I decided not to go out. My body is telling me, stay indoors. It's too hot. 3 o'clock in the afternoon is too hot to be in the garden. So we have to, I'm doing now is being early in the morning.
Yeah.
So 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock
before the heat garden,
and before the heat. So by 2 o'clock, everything is done, and then we just stay indoors. So nowadays, as you're gardening as well, you will start learning how your body react to the heat.
Mm-hmm.
One thing is to have a heat stroke, which is your body will go all dizzy and you feel fainting and your stomach is churning. On the other, you have the heat exhaustion, like your head kind of headache, you don't want to do, you have pain in your joints. It's very strange, so two different things. But both of them are serious. So drink lots of water and keep cool.
And if you've been looking after your garden, watering regularly, your garden's going to be pretty resilient, more than you are if you're starting to feel that way. Don't push yourself, I got to get this done. It's like, if you feel it.
Yeah, if you feel like if you're wearing shorts, you will feel your legs burning. You feel the sun on your legs, your arms as well. Just it's time to stop and be indoors and prevent to have get sick because the season is still going. So we don't want to go down with heat stroke or heat exhaustion and still thinking, I have to do the other thing. So.
Yeah.
Just be drink a lot of water and stay in the shade when this gets too hot.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much. Some great advice for our midsummer gardening. Thanks for joining us today, Pablo.
It was a pleasure to be here today.
And how do people find out more about Embark?
So Embark Sustainability is a non-profit organization that is based here in the Student Union Building in Burnaby Mountain Campus. We have lots of activities. We focus on food justice and climate equity, and you might know about Embark through our food rescue program that we host every Thursday between 1 and 3 o'clock in the Sideway Hall, and as well through the gardening cohorts that we carry over the year. So at the moment, last week we started the second summer cohort.
Yeah.
So we are meeting with the students for the next six weeks, sharing gardening tips, gardening skills, and maintaining the garden for the summer. Then we have other community kitchen that is coming at the end of the month.
Yeah.
We have another community kitchen which everyone is invited and to join us after 5 o'clock. And then some workshops will come. So if you're very much interested in what's happening with us, we are very active during this summer and fall, please visit our website at embarsustainability.org or follow our social media channels at embarsustainability.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Coming up in about a little over 10 minutes is Democracy Now! And then tomorrow on Speak Up, Danny will be live in the studio with Autumn Jean Cairns and Ivan Jankovic to talk about their upcoming event, Disorder 11, a queer variety arts showcase taking place on July 31st at the Venue Co-op. So tune in tomorrow at 10 a.m. for Tuesday's Speak Up with Danny to hear all about that. Democracy Now! Up in 10 minutes. And now we're going to talk about The Odyssey. Of course, Christopher Nolan has just released a blockbuster film retelling of The Odyssey, featuring a whole host of Hollywood big names.
Which they had a section on Democracy Now! Saying that it was made under exploitive situations in Morocco.
Interesting.
So that's one reason not to see it. I'm going to put it...
And you're going to tell us more reasons not to see it.
Well, I'm going to put it in context.
Okay.
One of the things is that... what I have here, sometimes I take books out of the library, I just see it. And this is a book that's called Timelines, the events that shaped history. It's mainly a bunch of charts. It starts at 10 million years ago, because that's when we started becoming humans. And one thing that kind of threw me is that we have here 750 BC. Greek poet Homer composes the Iliad and the Odyssey. And then we got something, 1776 BC, the earliest recorded Olympic Games held in honor of Zeus take place. That's previous to Homer being alive, creating the both of them, the Iliad and the Odyssey. The other thing is that I heard a podcast over the weekend, which is about Zeus, because there's a podcast about Greek culture in general. So I heard the one on Zeus. Now, the concept of Zeus existed prior to Homer.
Right. The gods go back further.
Well, Zeus is the god. Now, what's actually interesting is there's a person called Hesiod. Mm-hmm. He came after Homer. And this is the ones that, you know, he talks about Mother Earth. It's based on the fact that the Earth is flat, by the way, because Mother Earth is the Earth, and everything stems forth from that. Now, what's interesting about that, that was done after Homer, and it's sort of like an actual prequel, I guess, because it's sort of talking about how everything came into existence.
Right.
However,
but is that part of the general mythology of the Greek gods?
Because
almost all cultures will have an origin story of how the world started.
But what makes it a bit complicated, I think they already had inklings of these concepts previous to Homer.
Right.
So it's sort of a bit confusing a little bit. Now then, the other thing about it is that there was a this was previous to all this.
Yeah.
Thriving on the Greek island of Crete from about 3000 BC to 1450 BC. Was actually kind of a thriving trading situation that collapsed. There was a catastrophic event known as the Late Bronze Age Collapse, wiped out nearly major powers in the Eastern Mediterranean. That was at 1200 BC. And a lot of...
that's an incident they often talk about the Sea Peoples, because... There's all the cultures around that end of the Mediterranean, which Crete was one of them, and over like in the Levant, like where Lebanon and Israel are now. But, you know, and they all sort of collapsed around the same time. And it's not well understood exactly why that is.
Now, this is previous to what's called Western civilization.
Yeah.
The ancient Greeks, but after this... situation had happened. That's considered a Western civilization. Mm-hmm. Now, I put a question. I'm just going to put it here. I already did, because I got other stuff. Was Homer the beginning of Western civilization? The beginning. Because I asked the Google, I said, was the belief in Zeus the beginning of Western civilization? They said, no. Was the first Olympic Games the beginning of Western civilization? They went, no. But since I got so many other things in my little thing, Western, okay. Yeah.
So?
Oh, here's one. It says, Homer is not the very beginning of Western civilization, but there was one that sort of was more enthusiastic. It said that it was, which is, but it's sort of so that, so it's sort of, some cases they say that he was or he wasn't, that it's kind of evolved. Now, however, there was something that was created in 1952.
I'm dying to know what you think is the beginning of Western civilization.
These things, it's sort of a bugaboo term, isn't it? I mean, it's like... In fact, you know, the person that taught Bill Clinton at Georgetown University,
yeah,
his contention, which I think is false, he says, Western civilization didn't start until the very term Western civilization was created around the Renaissance, I guess. And that's sort of a bit silly. It's a retroactive concept.
Well, it always is, because, of course, but, you know, even on some level, the idea, you know, the Greek as being the starting point of Western civilization, or however you want to describe it, is sort of, again, an idea that partly formed by a very strong looking back at Greek culture,
right?
Ancient Greek culture and an obsession with, the ancient Greece within the academics in the West and people in the West. Did you know? Sorry, I'm just going to say this quick fact that the Greeks, they used to call themselves their term for themselves was Romans throughout the Ottoman occupation, and they didn't really start calling themselves Greeks until all the Western European academics and the great interest in Greek culture focused so much attention on that period of time and its heritage that around that time, which is in the 17th and 18th century, is when they started calling themselves Greeks instead of referring to themselves as Romans, because they were part of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire.
That's a rather confusing fact, because the ancient Greeks were taken over by the Romans.
Yeah, but then they became part of the Roman Empire,
yeah,
and the Byzantine Empire was effectively a continuation of the Roman Empire, even though the Western Empire disappeared in the West, and they identified as Romans, even though the culture of the Byzantine Empire was Empire was in fact Greek. Anyway, you're going to tell us why, what was wrong with the movie, and why people shouldn't go.
In 1952, Britannica Encyclopedia did the Great Books of the Western World.
Yeah,
and that's just they did a revision of it in 1990. But I'm going to stick to the 1952 variation.
Okay.
So it begins with the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yeah.
So that's when they start this, and it ends with Freud, of all things. I'm going with the 1952 one, because what's sort of interesting is that they got Karl Marx. This, yeah, is the height of McCarthyism. They include Karl Marx in it. They got I think Adam Smith and so on. And it ends with Freud, who did one of the worst theater critic
thing. Okay, we got 1 minute to wrap this up.
Okay, it's wrapped up. I think we got it. Anyway, don't see the movie.
Do you think people shouldn't see the movie?
Because it's a silly thing. I mean, Plato and Aristotle's a bit more of a lasting impact. Maybe the commies are Aristophanes or something. I mean, anyway, so there was some more I could have said, but anyway, I just don't see it. It was done on our exploitation, and it's probably going to be pretty boring. I don't know. Do you think it's going to be exciting? It's just, I mean, you have to believe in it if you believe in it. Who believes in this anymore? No one.
It's just storytelling.
Have you seen this movie already?
I have not seen the movie already. It only came out this weekend and probably busy in the theaters, but I will go see it.
Oh,
I
really?
Probably will go. I would like.
We're going to have to call Amy Goodman. What conference?
You're going to tell on me?
Amy Goodman, you can't. Anyway, I don't agree with everything with Amy Goodman.
Okay.
Also,
well, Amy Goodman is coming up in about 15 seconds on Democracy Now! And maybe she'll have more to say about the Odyssey as well, but probably a whole lot about Trump and everything he's doing to destroy the United States. Democracy Now! Is coming up right about now. Stay tuned for a lot more great programming here.